Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today, our guest is Nancy Long, who is the executive director at 501 Commons. Nancy, thank you for being the guest today.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
This is really great, and I've really appreciated our prior discussions, about everything nonprofit related. I know you have a ton of experience, so it's really an honor to have you today. Do me a favor, why don't you share with us the mission of 501 Commons, talk a little bit about its history, and why are you passionate about the work that you all are doing?
Great topic. Always love to talk about our history and our purpose. So 501 Commons is a nonprofit that supports the success of other nonprofits. We do that by amplifying their strengths with the ultimate goal to be improving life for people and communities that the nonprofits serve. And the way that we do that amplification of nonprofit strengths is through providing expertise in finance, technology, data systems, HR, management consulting, fundraising, and other related areas. So that is obviously a very wide mission. We provide services both in a consulting mode, so projects that have a start, middle, and finish, and also ongoing services, or what's often called back office services, in finance, tech, data systems, and HR. The way that we are put together is a reflection of the way that our nonprofit sector is put together. So nonprofits typically have budgets under $1 million. At that level, they have primarily program staff and often an executive director and executive leadership team. And rarely do they have anyone on staff that has expertise in areas like finance or HR or technology or data systems. But they need that expertise to be really successful in their mission. And most nonprofits will stay small. They're not just early stage small, they're small for their whole lives. And so we can come in and provide a fractional FTE expert who can be their HR person, be their tech person, and so forth. And so our growth and development has reflected that response to those needs in our sector, both the breadth of topics and the way in which we provide services. We are also the sponsor of a statewide fundraising event called Give Big Washington, which is happening next week on the 3rd and the 4th. So we're super excited right now and charged up because last year, we raised about $17 million overall in donations and in-kind and match. And so it's they're really big days for our state of Washington.
That's awesome. Tell us, I don't want to get too off topic because there's some specific things I want to talk about related to just kind of the current state of the nonprofit industry. And I want to get into the wage report and study that you all had put together. But I'm curious, on the Giving Days, how many years has this one been running in the state of Washington?
This is, I think, the 13th year for this one. We took it on in 2019 from our local community foundation, the Seattle Foundation. And so it's one of the longer, lasting Giving Days in the country, and one of the larger ones. And then when we took it on, we made it statewide types of organizations. For us, it's great to raise that money. It's money that nonprofits need, comes mid-year. It's unrestricted funds. All of that is good, good, good. But it's also very much a pathway for teaching nonprofits about fundraising. And online fundraising in many ways is the easiest kind of fundraising to get good at and to exceed at, but it provides a base for organizations to really learn about stewarding donor relationships and building donor confidence in their organization and so forth. So we see it as part of our capacity building mission as well as just a great opportunity to put some dollars in the pockets of over 1,500 organizations in our state.
That's amazing. I'm curious, like, for you to comment, there's certain trends, you know, that happen, and we work with organizations across the country. And one of those trends that has been really interesting to me are the Giving Days. And I mean, what was it like before that existed? If you take it back and then right now, I mean, I think people are sort of familiar with them, and, you know, we have them here in Austin, other cities in Texas. I've been involved in the Austin one. I've been involved and know the folks that run the San Antonio one. So that's been really interesting. But can you take us through, I mean, why were these initially created? And it seems kind of so obvious now, and they've had a lot of success, but I mean, what do you think went into that?
Gallup Foundation's motive for doing it, as they described it, really was a capacity building motive. And it's very much to their credit that they, you know, saw that online fundraising was emerging, and that organizations at that point when they started, most organizations didn't have any conception about how to use social media to attract, retain and educate potential donors. And so they wanted to help organizations learn about online giving in particular, and the techniques of social media. The social media part has come up just because it's, you know, it's in our culture, right? So there's not a lot of need at least the kind of beginning level to teach people about social media now, although the more sophisticated strategies and the more strategic use of social media is still an important growth area for nonprofits. But I think what they saw was that government funding was trending down at that period. We're in a period of high government funding right now, but that won't last for long. And most of that funding is going to a very small part of the nonprofit community. And as an organization, as a community foundation that raises money itself and then puts that money out in grants, they understand that grant funding is not dependable for nonprofits. They understand the challenges of fundraising, even though they're doing it in the kind of deeper end of the pool with larger donors. So I think there was, on their part, there was a capacity building motive behind them getting into it. And so similar when it came to us, that's our primary connection with it. Just helping people understand that something like a giving day is not a lottery ticket. You don't just put up your page and sit back and wait for the dollars to roll in. You have to be engaging with donors. And of course, the big thing in online giving right now is peer-to-peer fundraising. So where you get, you know, five people passionate about your mission to go out and talk to their network. And they're able to bring in new donors because they obviously know people who are not yet connected to the organization. And during the pandemic, the ability of giving days to bring in our case, about 20% of the donations are first-time donations. And so the ability of giving days to bring in those new donors has been critical, because you're not throwing, you know, backyard barbecues, and you're not having walkthroughs with your facility. You're not just kind of casually running into people that you can, you know, help build into a donor relationship. So they've been very, very critical during the last 2 years.
That's awesome. I really appreciate you sharing that. Speaking of the last 2 years, I know that 501 Commons more recently put out the King County Nonprofit Wage and Benefits Survey. Can you talk to us about that? And just in general, what have you learned, and how are you communicating that, and then therefore, you know, working to help the organizations that you serve find solutions?
Yes. So first of all, your audience can find this survey report and data by going to 501commons.org and just in search, put in putting people first. And that will take you to a page that talks about this project, but links to the project report, which has compensation information for 171 salaries from 230 organizations, which is one of the larger salary surveys in our country. But most exciting, there's a webpage that gives you a searchable way to look at the data, to compare multiple jobs and look at the compensation data across those jobs. That is valuable and really groundbreaking for the sector, because many nonprofits, because they are small, have kind of combo jobs. You know, so somebody will be the finance slash office manager slash volunteer manager. And so when you're trying to create a fair compensation strategy for those kinds of positions, you actually have to look at multiple positions and kind of weight the salaries to match the kind of job that somebody has. So the data is really important. And while it's King County data, comes from our largest county in Washington State, which includes Seattle and Bellevue, the a major population center in Washington State, I think it is very much in line with other, at least coastal cities, in terms of the wage level. We have a little bit more pressure on tech jobs in our area, probably than in some other areas. But basically, other kind of coastal cities, larger cities with, you know, higher labor markets can probably use that information with some reliability, and others could discount it. If you tend to have a lower, you know, wage level than our King County area, you could, you know, the relative salaries would still be relevant, but you could discount it. So in addition to that, there's an analysis that looked at the impact of COVID on nonprofits. No surprises that there, it looks very much like the national impact studies, with the arts and culture sector being hardest hit in our community. But there's some interesting information there about who's really been hit hard and those that have actually seen upticks in funding through the pandemic. There's an analysis around executive director compensation and benefits, and that's important because boards are required under IRS rules to look at some comparative information when they set executive salaries, and a lot of boards are not doing that. And so pulling our study and other studies from around the country could be helpful to boards. And there's a whole analysis of benefit offerings that provides some interesting information as well as compensation practices. We have far to go in our sector in terms of formalizing the way that employees are paid and the way that pay levels are set. There's a lot of just finger to the wind kind of setting of salaries in our sector, or just getting by with the lowest salary we can possibly pay to conserve resources, paying people slightly above what they were paid at their last job and so forth. The laws are starting to really tighten around compensation practices in our country in general, with greater requirements around pay equity based on gender and sometimes race. In our state, it's right now focused on, we have a pay equity law that focuses on gender, that requires a lot of discipline in how organizations set pay and how they look at comparable pay across their organization. So we're trying to really lift up these practices in the sector. Many times, while we may think that we are, you know, the more kind and benevolent sector, many times nonprofits are actually implementing very poor compensation practices and practices that leave them vulnerable to lawsuits. And worse yet, because it has a broader impact, practices that reduce the loyalty of their staff to their organization. You know, right now, everybody knows there's, you know, difficulty in finding employees. We have a tight labor market. Nonprofits are getting hit very hard by that, to the level that there are nonprofits that are very close to closing their doors because they can't find employees. And there are definitely many nonprofits that are providing less service than they have been able to provide in the past, because they simply don't have the staff to deliver the services. So it's time for us as a sector to wake up and, you know, improve our pay practices, improve pay, which means taking our case to our donors, to philanthropy and to government actors that are setting contract rates and getting more money into the sector so that our pay can be more equitable with the other parts of our sector, like government, philanthropy, and health and education.
I greatly appreciate you sharing all this, and I am in total agreement with you in terms of what you're sharing and what needs to change. A question I have for you is that a lot of donors, and I think it's changing as each year goes by a bit more and more, but a lot of donors look at an organization and they really care how many cents out of every dollar that they give is going towards the mission. And so it just sort of occurred to me that I've seen different organizations message it, but being in the position that you're at 501 Commons and this kind of this organization serving all these others, do you ever do or engage in sort of like PSAs or more like broad ways to sort of educate donor base of like why these salaries need to be higher and why more spending needs to go, you know, towards that versus just the mission?
Yes. Yes. Well, very good question. We are doing more of that with this data in hand. It helps to have data when you're telling that.
Sure.
We do that through our participation in Give Big and our statewide giving day. And we do definitely, we message out, I think, about the strengths of our sector. We're a very resilient sector. When you consider how little government funding went into the nonprofit sector, it's amazing that we didn't lose, you know, 30% of the organizations. But people buckle down, they conserve, they bring in volunteers. You know, there's a lot of strategies that nonprofits use that sort of get them through to another day. And, you know, nonprofits survive year after year, some of them for as much as 100 years, that when you look at their budgets and beginning of their budget year, you think, how is this organization ever going to make it? And yet they do year after year after year. It's pretty miraculous. And similarly with during COVID, at least in our state, there was almost no support for nonprofits. While there was tons of support that went out to businesses. The state took the position that businesses were valuable to save and support, but nonprofits were not. And funded, you know, in the arts area, because that was the hardest hit and the best organized, but funded very little in other areas. And so I think that we do try to give that voice to the sector, to both the resilience of the sector, but also resilience in the face of really structural problems in how we fund nonprofits. We are culprits in that. So the problem that you're talking about sort of telling donors that, you know, 100% of your donation is going to go to, you know, the direct service to the client or recipient, that's a lie. That is an absolute lie. And it shouldn't be told. And we should stop saying that stuff. And we should educate donors, because money doesn't do the work, people do the work. And, you know, behind every program, there are people, even if those people are volunteers, and much of our sector is still driven by volunteers, it takes some resources to support those volunteers. And it takes some administrative structure to make that volunteering efficient and effective. So nonprofits need to start educating donors, philanthropy, and government so that we can get these practices changed. You know, government will competitively bid services to support their computers, to, you know, care for grounds for government buildings, provide services that they need to do maintenance and so forth. But with a nonprofit, they put out proposals where they set the rates and the nonprofits can take it or leave it. And there's no reason why there should be a difference in how contracts to nonprofits are handled versus contracts to businesses. And nonprofits are going to have to band together and walk away from some of these contracts, because government's getting away with paying, you know, 40% of the cost of the service. And there just isn't that other invisible force out there that's picking up the rest of the 60%. So it's no longer reasonable to sort of tolerate those kinds of contracting processes.
That's pretty unbelievable. I never really was aware of this, but I guess that's part of the show and getting to meet leaders like yourself. So thank you for sharing it. And I hope that there is improvements. Carrying that forward, I'm curious, one of the questions I like to ask is, what do you think are some of the best practices to run a financially stable organization? One of the things that I heard that I really appreciated, I hadn't given much thought to, the importance of a board in terms of them setting the compensation and trying to use other, peer nonprofits as a guide to figure out. Can we focus a little bit on that? I mean, what is really like the role of the board there, especially not just in a qualitative way, but maybe like how the IRS views it or kind of the fiduciary responsibilities when it comes to compensation in the board?
So IRS does require that boards, when they set executive salaries, so the salaries that they are responsible for, which usually is just the executive salary, that boards investigate what the pay levels are for similar organizations. Mm-hmm. So similar field, similar size, similar budget, and supervision responsibilities, and set a salary for their executive or executives that is on par with those, with the data that they gather through that process. It's interesting, this goes back to the kind of the way that our country views nonprofits. It's interesting that that's how government chooses to, intervene in nonprofits, mm-hmm. is by limiting the salary of the executives. There's no such provision around a business, but with nonprofits, you have to stay on par with your competitors. If there's a difference, you need to be able to justify that difference. And whether the IRS is ever going to ask you to justify is another question, but the law does require that there be competitive information gathered and some justification for the salary that is offered. I think that to your question about the way the best practices in terms of financial practices, one of them goes back to this issue of how we tell our story to donors and how we increase pay. Many nonprofits don't understand the full cost of services. And so they will write a grant asking for the funding to provide the program, including only the cost of program staff, maybe not including taxes and benefits that they have to pay those staff, maybe not including the program overhead, the direct kind of program management, almost always not including the overhead costs, the rent, the overall management of the organization, the cost of utilities, and so forth. And so we are underrepresenting the true costs of the services that we are essentially selling to funders. And so we're kind of creating the problem for ourselves by doing that. And not understanding the full cost of services means that you can also get yourself in trouble by taking program grants that outstrip your organizational capacity and create problems in being able to actually deliver on the grant. One of the reasons our county was interested in the wage and benefit study is they were seeing this pattern where organizations would start to really get traction on their program outcomes, and then there would be turnover, and that turnover would take talent and knowledge out of the organization, and the program outcomes would fall. And so if we're not able to offer stable employment and employment where people can grow in their careers and advance their knowledge and their professional standing, get higher pay as they have a longer tenure in the field, we're going to be constantly losing that talent and the knowledge that really powers the effectiveness of the services that we offer. It's really important that we find a way to engage across this country in a conversation about improving pay in the nonprofit sector, because our communities are highly dependent on the services that nonprofits provide, and government is highly dependent on the services that nonprofits provide. Government assigns a lot of important roles to nonprofits and then somehow just expects it to work out. And it's not working out. I really believe we are going to start to see, you know, major structural damage and failure in the nonprofit sector, despite our historic resilience, unless we intervene and change the way the sector is funded and the way the sector operates internally around compensation.
Well said. How do you champion that? I mean, what you're doing in the state of Washington is awesome. Are there ways that, knowing that this is just a national issue, that you work on behalf with other state associations or state organizations?
We're just starting that process. And certainly being with you today, Stephen, is part of that. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these issues. And I welcome people to contact me if this is an issue that they, you know, see as a common cause.
Sure. Well, that's how I see it. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it will take all of us stepping forward. It will take some innovation in practices, and it will take getting the attention of these other parts of the sector to make any kind of a change happen. And so, we work in about 25 states in any one year. So we have service relationships throughout the country. We have some partnerships with other organizations that do similar work as we do in capacity building throughout the country. And we work with, in terms of the wage study, we work with Nonprofit Compensation Associates, which is the organization that has done most of the wage studies around the country. So Rita Hironian, who's the consultant that we worked with the Nonprofit Compensation Associates, is herself a wealth of information and somebody who can share a lot of information with people through the wage studies that she's done in Northern and Southern California in the past, in New England and other, you know, other states. So they've done more than 50 studies. So that's one of the places to start. I would recommend that you take the example we have of trying to interest government or funders in providing the underlying funding to do a wage study in your community. And then that gives you data to talk about. Seattle is also doing a study that compares nonprofit human services wages to for-profit wages for similar type positions. That will be interesting. And as far as I know, that's a first of its kind of study. I think that the sector needs to take the position that when we look at comparisons, we're looking not so much at nonprofit to for-profit as nonprofit to the other parts of the nonprofit sector: government, philanthropy, most of education, most of healthcare, because those are the fields that we lose employees to. We lose some to business for sure, but most of the draw for people who enter the nonprofit sector often earlier in their career, they go off to government jobs or jobs in those other related sectors. And the differences there are even worse than the difference between nonprofit and for-profit, because government, education, healthcare are the higher paid jobs in our economy. So that's where we should be looking for equity, is in that comparison, I believe.
Awesome. I appreciate you sharing that. And for anyone listening, I know you had talked about where to find the King County Nonprofit Wage and Benefits Survey report, but I'm right on your website right now, so I'll just mention that it's simply 501commons.org. That's 501commons.org. Nancy, is there anything else you'd like to share? Any other ways that, people can get involved or suggestions you have?
We're also just about to release an employee engagement survey that we did at the same time last year. And that those results will also be on that same page, putting people first. And I think that will be important and interesting to people as well. While this, again, represents King County organizations, I suspect it pretty accurately reflects nonprofit employees across the country. Those results are incredibly inspirational in that people showed a very high level of satisfaction when it comes to the belief that they're doing important work and that their work is making a difference in the community. They're very, you know, signed up for the mission of their organizations. And I think, you know, during COVID, even though those missions often had to shift significantly in both what organizations were doing and how they were doing it, that there was an enthusiasm and a kind of a re-energizing of people with the importance of their work. The dissatisfaction points are no surprise, what we've just been talking about, which is nonprofit wages and compensation, and some practices in nonprofits about how those issues are handled within nonprofits. So I recommend that to your listeners as well. There's no financial stability in an organization that cannot maintain its staff and maintain a long tenure with its staff, because having tenured employees that really know their job and know the community well and, you know, going deep into the ways that their services can make a difference is ultimately what's going to give an organization financial viability and organizational viability. So,
well said. Well said. Yeah, I got to tell you, I really appreciate that. I've never had spoken with anyone or had a guest on that has kind of on the air, off the air, honed in on that as the financial stability piece. And it's so true. Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that. Nancy, thank you so much for being a friend and for coming on this episode.
Well, it was my pleasure. I welcome any contact from people who are interested and fired up on these issues and all, you know, ideas that people have about how we can make significant structural changes happen in our sector. And I appreciate so much what you're doing, Steve, and what Charity Charge is doing, because it's a part of that leveling the ground for how nonprofits have to operate in a way to create greater viability for organizations if they take advantage of the services that you offer and the program that you offer. So thank you for having me today.
The feeling is mutual. Thank you for that. I will wrap up this episode. Thanks again for everyone who's been listening and joining along our journey here at Charity Charge with the podcast. Take care until next episode.